I miss a green, for example, I'm already upset. When I find my ball in the bunker, I'm really upset. And when I find my ball in a
fried egg.
The dreaded fried egg.
Fried egg lie, I'm about ready to run off the golf course.
Ladies and gentlemen, welcome back to another edition of the Fried Egg Podcast. We have a second podcast this week and excited to bring on Jake Nichols. Jake is the head of intelligence at the 15th Club, which is a golf analytics company that helps players kind of analyze and look at their stats to play better. Some of their players, they have a lot of European Tour players, are Danny Willett, Darren Clark, Lee Westwood, Matt Fitzpatrick, Juice Luton, Torbjørn Olesen, and many more. Jake, thanks for coming on.
Thanks a lot, Andy. Appreciate you having me.
Yeah, I'm excited to kind of get into, you know, what everybody needs to know about the sabermetrics of golf. To kick things off, I'd love to hear a little bit about how you got into it and your background.
Yeah, sure. So I was always a golf fan more than anything. I played a little bit when I was younger, but I was always much more of a fan. And then in college, really started to get into looking at sports in a statistical way. So baseball and basketball were the two big ones back then. And after a year or two of, you know, reading blog posts and books and whatever was available in those sports, I started to wonder why golf didn't have very many people operating it in it. And this was before Mark Brody and Strokes Gained got big, before his book came out. And so there were only a handful of people really in the corners of the internet who were analyzing golf with data. So I just picked it up as a side hobby in college, and it's grown into a full-time job with 15th Club for the last 2 years.
That's cool. Did you do anything else before you got into that in the working world?
Nope. This was pretty much straight out of college, after a little bit of loafing around the house.
That's cool. So tell us a little bit about, like, what's a day in the life for you? Like, what do you do on a daily basis with, like, golf numbers, and like, how does it work?
So it could be really anything. Right now I'm working on a report for one of our players, basically a checkup for him. He's off for a few weeks now, so he's looking for a breakdown of his game. How's he trending over the first few months of the season? So it could be that. It could be working on a consulting project for one of our clients. We've gotten involved in a lot in the last 6 months to 12 months, and just how can golf organizations use their data better? So it's analyzing data. It's working on software tools to help the players capture their data better, to help these organizations track their data better. So a lot of numbers, a lot of coding, a lot of data visualization, which I really enjoy. And then, you know, just figuring out how best to communicate insights to the players, caddies, other clients.
Uh-huh. So, you know, we've seen like this sabermetrics boom in baseball and basketball, where, you know, they've kind of completely revolutionized the sport and, you know, the philosophies behind the sport, how you assemble teams, how you even, you know, draw plays in basketball. How far behind is golf from that?
So I would say, when I think about using data in like the sports arena, I think there's kind of three phases. The first is someone decides to start tracking all this stuff. So the PGA Tour installed ShotLink cameras over a decade ago. So now they have all this data to play with. So the second stage is kind of convincing people that data can be used to create insights, that we can learn from it, that it can help players play better, it can help the tour, you know, organize events better. It can, you know, do all this stuff basically what we're doing right now. And then the final stage is it's fully accepted. And I think in baseball, it's fully accepted. All the teams use it. Everyone talks about it. It's on the broadcasts. It's in the studio shows. I really think golf is still kind of in that second stage where we're still trying to convince some people out there, some stakeholders in the game, some players, you know, of the validity of the results, how it can help them out, and really get everyone comfortable with talking about data. So I really think it's, you know, it's behind baseball for sure, but it's also a little bit easier than like applying analytics to basketball, where you have to track the ball and 10 players in this court. You can, you know, kind of only focus on where's the ball positioned at each time or one player's swing. Mm-hmm. So it's a little bit easier of a problem than basketball or hockey or football.
What would you say is the biggest pushback that you get? Like, what's the most regular kind of feedback against the analytics and using them to kind of try and, you know, analyze performance?
I would say there's a few things. The first is a lack of understanding of how this is different. Strokes gained, it takes a while to really understand it intuitively, I think. You can't really understand it intuitively, I mean. So I think there's a little disconnect. You know, how can you know this is better than just looking at the stats that I've looked at for 10 years or 20 years, or maybe don't look at it at all? And the second one is when it conflicts with what the player or the caddy or the coach is seeing with their eyes. Try telling a player who you think his iron game is merely average that, and he might think it's, you know, top 25 in the world because maybe he's getting the consistent contact that he's looking for. You know, his swing feels great, but maybe the results just aren't there, or the strategy in the shots just aren't there. So there's, it's difficult sometimes where there's some resistance to what the data is telling you. Mm-hmm.
So with, when you guys start working with players, you know, what kind of stuff does that encompass? Obviously it's, you know, looking at their stats, you know, does it go into, you know, you touched on strategy. Does it go into how to play the course and different tendencies and stuff like that?
So the initial step that most of our clients come to us with is, I just want to track my performance, track how I've been playing in all these different areas. So we have a tool, a software tool that they can enter their data into. It tracks their data over time. They can, you know, slice and dice it however they like to look at it. And that kind of data is really used to influence everything else we do with them, mm-hmm. in terms of reports and strategy and, you know, everything else. So that's kind of the initial thing, is someone will come to us and say, you know, I'm just looking to improve, looking to get better. How can you help me track my performance and, you know, and figure out what's the one or two things that I need to work on to, you know, become a top 50 player, top 25 player, top 10 player eventually. Mm-hmm. And then once we have that sort of data, once they're integrated into that sort of software tool, then some of them are more interested than others in things like on-course strategy. So we have a few guys who we help prepare for some of the big events, and some guys who are interested in it week to week. Just, what can you tell me about the course? What can you tell me about, you know, what should I be working on in the last 3 weeks of practice before the Masters? What sort of shots am I going to face at the tournament that I should be preparing for? And then at the end of the year, there's some clients who are interested in scheduling. You know, what's the one or two courses that I should play this year that I don't normally play, that whether it's something about the field or something about the course fitting my game, that I can really get an edge and maybe outperform my normal level of play at that course.
Interesting. So with the, you know, the specific courses, is there, you know, how much is like the horses for courses? Is it, you know, overplayed or how real is it?
It's definitely a factor for sure. I've seen some people dismiss it because if you look at just the thing is, if you look at just results of players at a course, so this guy's gone to Sawgrass his last five times and he's had four top tens, it's not really telling you that much because it might be that that player is just really good. You know, if that's Henrik Stenson and he's top 10 four times out of five, well, maybe that's pretty close to what you'd expect there. So the actual – it's difficult to tease horses for courses out of the data. I don't think you can just look at a – you know, look at a sheet that gives you his results for the last 10 years and there's more to it. It's more about how – you know, how does that player's game fit with the course statistically? And if we can figure that out, then we can go to tell Matt Fitzpatrick or Danny Willett, who have never played a lot of the PGA Tour courses, and we can say, well, our numbers say your game fits well at Colonial or your game fits well at the Travelers, et cetera.
Mm-hmm. It's interesting. So with regards to kind of, you know, how you guys weight things, and obviously with Mark Brody's kind of strokes gained book, he put a big discount on kind of putting and, you know, just preached about how, you know, tee to green was so much more important and anything inside of 50 yards was relatively, you know, everybody's the same. What would you say is the biggest difference between, say, your, you know, top 50 player and number like 250? In the world rank, like, you know, somebody that's kind of like a fringe tour guy, whether it's European Tour or PGA Tour, kind of bouncing between the web.com or the Challenge Tour and the big tour.
I still would think it's sort of ball striking stats. Mm-hmm. For sure. I would say probably a combination of long game and also driving ability. So I imagine there's a lot more guys in that sort of churn area between the web and the big tour who can hit it a mile but can't control it. Mm-hmm. And there's a lot of guys in that top 50 in the world range who maybe don't hit it as far as those big hitters, but they're really controlling it. They're putting it in play. And that kind of above average distance plus – you know, average-ish accuracy is really, really what sets players apart. So yeah, definitely long game is kind of still the separator at that level.
And I'm curious, something I look at is I kind of think that the world rankings and the PGA Tour is a byproduct of the golf courses they play. A couple weeks ago at Harbortown, you see like a distinctly different leaderboard than you do week over week of the PGA Tour. And I think there's a few courses that kind of fit that mold. Do you think that, the golf courses that the PGA Tour plays, the TPCs, the courses that really value, you know, kind of, do you think the courses diminish what a player's skill inside 100 yards as much and then promote the long game? Or do you think it's in terms of like your everyday golf, that long game is more important?
See, I think there's definitely rewards based on the change in the game over the last 15 years, the ball change and the distance change. There's rewards to making the courses fit that sort of elite PGA Tour player. Mm-hmm. But I don't really think that they diminish talent inside 100 yards, sort of short game. Right now on tour, the average course you hit driver about 10 times around or so, which I think is a pretty reasonable middle ground. It doesn't give the best hitter, like best drivers in the world, the ability to hit driver on every single hole. And it also doesn't really take it out of their hands for 10 holes around.
Yeah.
I think the rough is definitely more playable than maybe is fair towards really to promote letting those big hitters out of jail when they rip off a loose one.
Okay. Because I think a lot of it, you know, obviously conditioning too, firm and fast conditions. How do you guys see, you know, like conditions play a factor, like whether a course gets rain soaked and it's soft versus, you know, firm and fast? Do you see, you know, differences within the same golf course, say like a Riviera where it was soaked this year versus, you know, when it's played firm and fast in the past?
I've never actually looked at it, but you can. I imagine if you look at the scoring, you can definitely see it come out in the scoring, and see it come out in really all the other stats. Mm-hmm. We saw it at the match play this year, where the fairways were basically concrete, and the balls were just running out 375. And also when the greens slow down, you definitely can notice it in the punting stats. I think it was at Innisbrook a few years ago where they had reseeded the greens or changed something with the green surface.
Yeah.
And everyone was leaving the putt short. And it was, we like to look at this stat, like how often do you get it to the hole or just past the hole with your putts? And that course was like breaking our scale that year, just because the players weren't used to putting on the surface. So conditioning can be a huge factor with putting for sure.
I remember that it was their brand new greens, and yeah, everybody left it short. So with that stat, getting it to the hole, like what are some other stats that you guys look at that, you know, aren't, you know, on PGAtour.com?
A few of the course specific ones that I like to look at week to week is what kind of trouble can you get into off the tee? Mm-hmm. So if we compare how a player scores from the rough or the fairway bunker to how they score from the fairway, and then just average that for all the different players at each hole, you can get the value of how much it costs you if you don't hit the fairway.
Okay.
And that can range at Sawgrass, East Lake, I think Muirfield Village, they're up near about half a stroke penalty. Average is somewhere around 0.3 or 0.3 and a half. And then on the low end, you get your Augusta Nationals or Riviera. I think this week's TBC Louisiana is low, somewhere down 0.2. So that kind of gives you an indication of, you know, how much does it pay to be a straight hitter this week versus another week.
Uh-huh. So, you know, there's always a lot of debate with Augusta and, like, you know, does putting matter? Like, what does a right to left ball flight matter? Like, in your estimation, what are the most important stats there?
So definitely distance, since the course got lengthened. That's most years that stands out as something that really predicts scoring. And there's a few reasons for that. Number one is it gives you the ability to attack some of those holes, like 13 and 15. Number two, if you can get it around the corner, number 10. And the second one is most big hitters also are a little wild off the tee. So at Augusta, if you miss the fairway, either you're in the second cut, which is basically nothing, or you're in the trees and you can normally play a shot out towards the green. There's very little penalty for being wild. So if you're a big hitter who hits it 20 yards past the field and maybe uncorks really one poor shot around, at Augusta that one poor shot isn't really costing you like it is elsewhere. Mm-hmm. So I would say those are the big things. And that would kind of played out this year. Sergio's a big hitter. Justin Rose is a big hitter.
It seemed like Sergio was hitting it further than he usually does. I don't know. Just from the naked eye, was he like? I mean, was that an extraordinarily long performance for him?
It's definitely above average. Sergio is one of those guys who I kind of have the same reaction to you. He's sneaky long in some of these events, mm-hmm. Where he's hitting it. You don't really think of him as somebody who's a big hitter, but he definitely was at Augusta. He was right up there with not quite Rory, but with hanging with the next tier guys.
So with, you know, kind of the world golf rankings, like how do you view the world golf rankings? And if you're kind of opposed to them, how would you change the rankings to better really gauge who's the best player in the world at a time?
Okay. So there's two things. One is numerous people have found they're a little biased against PGA Tour players, favoring players from other tours, which is definitely valid. It's easier for – because the official World Golf Ranking has something called a minimum points. So these really weak events on the European Tour, the Japanese Tour, the Asian Tour are fixed – that they have to award at least a certain number of points. Mm-hmm. And what happens is these events have quite weak fields compared to PGA Tour events, but they're still awarding the minimum number of points that makes them look stronger than they really are. Uh-huh. So there's a few players every year who are benefiting from going perhaps to the Hero Indian Open and winning an event that maybe it should award 12 points, but it awards 24. And the second thing is the World Golf Rankings really reward accomplishment. So finishing number one is always better than finishing number two in a comparable event.
Yeah.
And that, I mean, it makes sense as something that they're really designed to decide who gets into these big events, and accomplishment the golf world has decided is the best way to figure out who gets to be in these events. It's completely different if you're trying to judge who's performing better, who's playing better, who the better player is, if you put them out on the course for 18 holes. Mm-hmm. And that you look at that numerous cases throughout the year where someone wins a tournament, maybe they only beat the field by 12 shots, the field average over the week, which is comparatively small. And then you have another, the extreme example of this is Stenson and Phil at the Open Championship last year. Mm-hmm. Phil Mickelson had probably the second best performance in a tournament in the last 15 or 20 years. Yeah. And he only got 50 world ranking points or 60 world ranking points. Whereas in any other event, if he had produced that performance, he would have, he would have won.
And then, so if I understand what you're saying, like a guy that, just is like a top 20 machine is kind of hurt by it, because they aren't awarded as many points as say, I think Kevin Chappell's kind of a good example of, this year he hasn't been playing very well, but he just started kind of found something, I feel like, the last couple of weeks. And, then he wins, probably not by that big of a margin, but he jumps 20 points in the world rankings.
Yeah, just for winning one tournament. Mm-hmm. I definitely agree. The fact is, if you finished in 20th place, I'd love to be able to quickly run the numbers for you, but I can't. If you finished in 20th place every week on tour, you'd be one of the best players out there. Uh-huh. But your world ranking, I don't think it would be very good. You might be in the hundreds, maybe. Just because you wouldn't have my intuition is that you wouldn't have enough points to challenge at the top.
That's interesting. But then it also comes down to definition of what the best player is. Is it consistency or is it wins? How would you go about valuing, say a player, when you start to look at, greatest players of all time and their scope of their career, you know, how do you weigh, you know, dominance and wins versus a guy, a consistency factor?
I think I rely a lot more on results, like wins, major championships, as the time scale gets longer. So if I'm judging a player's full career, maybe like Tiger versus Jack, then yeah, I think it's fair to look at, you know, majors and events won and those sort of things. Over a year, I think if you're judging who's the best player by who has five wins and who has three, then I think that will not lead you to the best player as often as looking at, you know, more performance-based metrics.
So it would be more like in the strokes gain department and everything, like and kind of those stats, less so on wins.
Yeah, exactly. Like at 15th Club, we have a stat called Performance Index, which basically rates every player in the world against each other. Based on, you know, adjusts for the strength of the fields that they play and the difficulty of the courses and weighs recent play more, all those things. And I think this week Rory is the number one player over anyone else. And I'm not so sure anyone right now would say Rory is the best player in golf. People would probably say DJ. But even before DJ fell down the stairs a few weeks ago, Rory was very close to DJ in our numbers, enough that 1 week could have changed things if DJ didn't play that well at the Masters. And I think anyone in their right mind right before the Masters would have said, you know, DJ is the best player in the world and it's not really close, because he had accomplished so much in his last, really, I guess, 9 months. But Rory, you see him week to week, is just – He's in the top 10 every single week, and he's often in contention and really right there with DJ.
On that list, on your guys' rankings, like, who are some surprises? I'm assuming, obviously, you've got, you know, Spieth up there, and Rahm is probably up there really highly based off of his recent success. But, you know, who are some kind of – I guess, like, I'm just kind of curious now.
Yeah, so until Rahm won, I think we had Rahm when he won in San Diego, he was rated in the teens in performance index before he won. And I think he was, where was he in the world ranking? Maybe
like 50th or 40th or something like that.
Yeah. Okay, he was outside the top 100 before he won, and then he was 46th after he won. So that's a good example of where the world rankings kind of screws a guy like him, who's just absolutely dominant for his first 20 events on tour. But it kind of pushes him back. Molinari is a guy who we have as a top 20 player right now. Again, he's extremely consistent. He's always, you know, just outside the mix. He's rarely missing cuts. Rafa Cabrera-Bello was like that for most of last year.
Yeah,
he kind of took a, maybe until the Ryder Cup, and maybe still isn't kind of popping up on people's radar. But he was rating as a very, very good player last year, and it's again because, you know, week to week he was playing so consistently well.
So if you were gonna say, like, you know, this is a guy that's gonna break out, that maybe not a name that's not on everybody's radar, like who could be the next, you know, Thomas Peters type breakout player, who would it be based off of numbers?
Ooh, that's tough. I'll have to give me about 10 minutes and I can come back to you with an answer.
Okay.
I'll do some searching on the sidelines while we talk.
So in terms of the, you know, kind of players that you're working with now, it's very European tour heavy. You know, is there any guys that you look at and think, like, I'd really like to work with this guy because I know we could make him, you know, a better player? Like, if so, like, who would be some names that you'd love to kind of work with and talk about, you know, where there might be some, you know, deficiencies that could, you know, greatly improve play?
Well, I'd love to work with Bryson just to experience what that would be like for a week, just to get inside of his head and see what crazy theories he's come up with on his own. So that's one. An interesting one who is way off the radar is J.J. Henry. A lot of the stats when I look at him, he pops up as someone who plays very conservative golf. Uh-huh. He lays up off the tee a lot. When we measure aggressiveness in terms of hitting the shots into the green, he always comes up as very conservative. I think if his putting numbers are conservative in terms of he's not really giving himself the chance to make putts sometimes by not getting it to the hole. Mm-hmm. So I think if we could sit down with him and have him buy in and maybe play a little more aggressive golf, then he could, you know, maybe he could improve. So that's kind of one off the radar.
Kind of amazing that's like, you know, one of Tron's like whipping boys. Tron Carter.
And you can absolutely see why it's his whipping boy, because he does. I would say he babies the ball around the course, so that he can, you know, make a cut and cash a check for 50th place.
Who would you say is the most miscast, you know, whipping boy of Tron?
Ooh, I think it has to be Brendan Steele. Brendan Steele is a big numbers, a big guy that numbers love. Uh-huh. I'm not sure how into numbers he is, but the numbers really like the changes he's made to his game. He's really improved how he drives the ball in the last few years. Mm-hmm. And he went from being completely ineffective off the tee, not long and not straight, to being a pretty big hitter who can really control his ball and really, really gains strokes in the long game now. So just in terms of golf ability that gets unnecessary abuse from Tron, I would say it's Brendan Steele.
I've always wondered that too, because he does, like, he rips it. And he plays pretty aggressive, but, you know, you get on the wrong side of Tron. I'm shocked that you brought up J.J. Henry.
he's someone who has always stood out in that sort of aggressiveness data. Mm-hmm. that we've looked at. So anytime I run a new stat, J.J. Henry is one of the first people I check where he is in it. And normally he's sticking out in some different direction.
Unbelievable. So do you say, like, I'm a web.com tour player and I have, you know, they don't really have like the shot link data and everything. How would I work with the 15th club and you guys? Like, how would you guys go about that? Would it be manual stats they'd have to keep?
Yeah, so right now most of our clients on the European tour will have their caddy track the data during the round, since the caddy already pretty much knows the length and lie of each shot. Just write that information down and input it into our app at the end of the round. It's really simple. It takes 10 minutes and you can immediately get feedback on how you played that day if you're interested in it. But yeah, it's manually tracked, and that is because the European Tour doesn't have a shot link-esque system. Neither do any of the other tours, so that's really designed to be a solution for LPGA players, web.com players, European Tour players, you know, anyone who doesn't have someone tracking that for them already.
Could be, you know, even amateurs like me, huh?
Yeah, absolutely. It's in discussion for an amateur product. There's a lot more competition in that space, but
yeah, I think about it because I play in, you know, AM stuff and mid-AM stuff, and I'm always curious about my game, and I kind of, like, I'm probably the exact person that you hate, because I'm like, well, I think I hit my wedges well, but it could have been, you know, terrible wedges. What would you say to, like, the, you know, everyday golfer? Like, say I wanted to get into thinking more analytically, what should I do?
I would say first start collecting data. No matter whether you use, you know, a product or a spreadsheet of your own, I would say start tracking, objectively tracking data on your game. Maybe if it's even one part, if you think, say you think your putting is very poor, take detailed notes of the 30 rounds you play this summer and how you putt. Mm-hmm. And that really, I mean, really I say this to a lot of our clients all the time, is we really need data to help you out. You know, we're not using our eyes. We're not using feel. We're judging based off data. And if you're an amateur who's, you know, who's looking to improve, rigorously track your data, however you can, and really judge where you are. And then maybe you spent all summer tracking your putting and you're actually not that bad. Yeah. And you can move on to something else, but maybe it reveals that you're really poor outside of 40 feet with your putting, or really poor inside of 10 feet with your putting. And that's something that you can then, you know, whether it's taking a lesson or looking for instruction, you can, you know, look to improve.
So if I wanted to go all in, I'm diving in, I'm going to collect the data. Like, how deep do you go? Do you say I hit a tee shot, I hit it 285 yards to the right center. Is it to like the specific side? Say I missed the fairway. Like how detailed would you go?
In our basic app that tracks player data, it's a simple amount of data just to get their strokes gain calculation out. Mm-hmm. You need the lie of the ball. You need the distance it is from the pin. Tell me if it's a impeded shot. Are you behind a tree? Because that changes things. Are you behind the lip of a bunker? And what's the club you used? And where did you miss relative to your target?
Okay.
Excuse me. So if you're aiming 10 feet right of the pin and you put it 60 feet right of the pin, then that's a miss to the right. And just that's the basic level of tracking data.
Interesting. So I imagine that one of the biggest things people mess up is how many feet away they are when they're putting. Because I always feel like people underestimate how far away they are. They'll be like, oh, I missed a 5-footer, but they were really like 8 feet away.
Or if they make that 5-footer, it turns into an 8-footer.
That's true. It's really interesting because I talked to USC's coach and they started to do strokes gained, and something he said to me that I found like really interesting was that they have above tour average ball strikers, but none of their players are above tour average putters, and that's the number one team program in the country. So like this is where my kind of bias where I say, like, putting really does matter, because these guys or is it that all these guys are so good at putting that it's diminished?
Yeah, so I think one of the things that's come out of Mark Brody's work is how important the long game is. Mm-hmm. And people have kind of stuck with that as the message, and that message is that it's the most important, not the only thing that matters.
Okay.
And I think that kind of gets lost sometimes. But definitely if you look at the spread between what the best and the worst putters are doing, it's smaller than the spread between what the best and the worst drivers and best and the worst approach shot players are doing. Mm-hmm. So really that is it on the pro tour.
I guess, yeah.
I have no idea how the USC results are coming out like they are. If they do really have tour level ball strikers in that program, that's incredible.
Yeah, I found it pretty interesting that like not even their best putter was a plus strokes gained player. But you know,
yeah.
I mean they do have like, you know, some of the best players in the country. You know, I think they've got two Walker Cuppers, and they've got that kid that played in the Masters like last year, who's a freshman who from China, Cheng Jin. So I mean, they have elite, you know, kids. But that's a good question. What would you say is, you know, kind of the barrier for, you know, like young kids when they come up? Like, is there a common skill that they usually lack, you know, when they're young and on tour?
Yeah, I would say without having studied it that closely, short game would be one. Course management would be another. Maybe you step on the tour and you can hit it long and your ball striking's okay, but you know, you're really inconsistent with a wedge. You don't chip that great. You can putt well inside 10 feet, but maybe when you lag it, you're awful. Mm-hmm. And those are just sort of the kind of things that you can solve by putting yourself into better places around the green. Maybe you don't play so aggressively in certain danger spots. So I would say those are the things that kind of separate
players. It's so much reps too, you know?
Oh, absolutely. Yeah.
And like the mental side of it. Like I think about myself, like, you know, in amateur tournaments when I was 24 versus now when I'm 31, and I think completely different. I play completely different. I play so, you know, like I'm just smarter. And I imagine that's a lot of like the maturation. Like I think Dustin Johnson's a good example with this wedge thing. It's like, it's not that he just started practicing. He might've learned, you know, stuff and along the way. It's not like he just started practicing wedges, right?
Yeah, no, absolutely. I think you're spot on with that. You just learn, how to be a better player. You learn how to attack different courses because you've seen them before. Mm-hmm. I think that's a big thing. I was listening to No Laying Ups podcast with Harold Varner, and Harold Varner said that, you know, he doesn't think Tiger even practices that much at the course because he's seen everything. And that's true. He's seen everything for 20 years. You know, he doesn't need to be out there grinding. Whereas, you know, maybe Harold Varner, a rookie or a second year player, you know, they do need to be out there grinding and learning these courses.
I was kind of surprised when he said he shows up to tournaments on Wednesdays.
Yeah, I mean, that's if it works for him. Yeah. I don't know how it works for him right now, but if that's if he likes to fly home every week, that's what you got to do.
Yeah. What would you say is like the disadvantage of a rookie? I mean, obviously they already have the chips stacked against them with regards to like the schedule and the ranking system, but playing these courses for the first time versus the veterans, like they've seen them for years. Like what would you say is like, you know, first time course like disadvantage? Is it a half a shot around or?
I don't think it's that big. I don't think it's that big at all. I think the disadvantage is really that a rookie's not going to be as good of a player. If you put the tour players in two different groups, rookies and non-rookies, the rookies are going to be just worse players just because it makes sense. You know, these veterans have been on tour for longer. They're normally more skilled players. So I think that really drives much of the disadvantage rookies face, is they just aren't as good.
So like, how good is Jon Rahm from a strictly numbers standpoint? Like what are you saying? Like I've said for a long time, he's got number one written all over him. And you know, I think now everybody's saying that, but like, is he a generational player?
I think he could be. Right now, I think he's already in that like second tier of players, mm-hmm. in terms of, you know, fifth, sixth, seventh best in the world. And just because his skills so far seem to be, he drives the ball extremely well and he hits his irons well. That's the kind of template that Rory and DJ have really ridden to the top of the game, you know, as they've slowly fixed flaws in their game and gained a tenth of a stroke here and a quarter of a stroke there. Jon Rahm is exactly the kind of guy I can see tweaking a few things and being, you know, the next new number one player in the world.
Mm-hmm. Who would you say is kind of like the outlier of stats? Is there anybody that just like, you know, based off of your numbers and then, but the performance is like the complete opposite of what your numbers would suggest?
There's a handful of guys who are quite inconsistent with how they play. Mm-hmm. They'll have weeks where they look outstanding and they'll contend in tournaments or win. And then they'll have a lot of weeks where where they're missing cuts and missing cuts badly. I think Thomas Peters was a guy like that for a long time, basically up until like last fall. Mm-hmm. And now he's, you know, whatever that leak was in those weeks, he's kind of fixed that, and he's so much better of a player. Mm-hmm. So yeah, a lot of those young, mostly young and inconsistent players are really the ones where stats don't tell as accurate of a story, because it's measuring their average week, which isn't very good, instead of their best weeks when they're contending and winning.
Yeah, I think that's and so much of that can be just adjusting to, you know, life as a PGA Tour player, traveling, being on your own, all that stuff.
Absolutely, yeah. All that sort of stuff that we discussed about 10 minutes ago, the adjustment to the tour life. You know, you go from being in a college campus or in a, you know, your national team's training facility for most of your time and practicing with the same people, and now you're spread around 20 countries around the world or all over the United States, and you're expected to perform or you lose your card.
Yeah.
It's a tough life.
So, you know, with this week being a new format, and I'm kind of interested to hear how you would do this. Like, how, if you were playing and, you know, or say you have a player that, you know, is in this event, how would you advise them about going to pick their partner? Because you always hear, oh, they'll be a great, their games complement themselves, each other so much. Like, they'll be a great, like, what would be your formula? And how cliched is the current one?
Well, the current one, I don't think it's fully thought through. In our Ryder Cup work, we delved into sort of what makes a good foursomes pairing. And what it really is about is player A and player B both have things they do well and both have things they don't do well. And it's kind of about putting player A in situations where they're not going to be causing player B to hit one of their bad shots. So if you have someone who struggles with their short game, pair them with someone who's just hitting greens relentlessly. So they're hitting a 40-foot putt instead of a 20-yard chip that they might screw up.
So Graham Dillette, you'd pair with like the best ball striker in the world.
Yeah, I'd put pair Graham Dillette with Graham Dillette.
Yeah,
so we'll see how that works this week without Graham Dillette hitting his approach shots into the green.
Oh man, I didn't even think about that. I wish I would have thought about that before. What else do you look at?
Okay, so I took a look at this this morning. Unfortunately, I was disappointed that we didn't have any players choosing to play this week, because I do think it's an interesting intellectual exercise. Uh-huh. So we kind of identify key shots throughout the course, and these are shots where the difference between how players perform on them is really wide, so that they can either hit a good shot that gets really rewarded, or they can hit a poor shot that gets really punished. Mm-hmm. And a good example of that type of hole is like 17 at Sawgrass.
Yeah.
It's only a short wedge. If you hit a good shot, you're going to make birdie. If you hit a poor shot, you're dead. You're in for double bogey. So we can do that for all holes on tour, and we can break it down even to look at key shots. So maybe on 18 at Sawgrass, the drive's a real key drive because you can get wet very easily. But maybe the approach isn't as important. Mm-hmm. So when we look at Zurich, there's a few holes that stick out, and it's like the closing stretch, the key holes all set up for one type of player to play one of them. If they play the odd tees, it sets up nicely for one group, and the guys playing the even tees, it sets up nicely for another.
Okay.
So basically it's like if you have a really good ball striker on your team, have them play one set. And then if you have somebody who's, you know, an accurate driver, good short game, putts well, then they're better at playing the other holes.
Interesting. So you're just going to, like, watch tomorrow and laugh at all the teams that mess this up.
Oh, if you don't think I'm going to criticize people, I might keep it off Twitter, but but there'll be silent judgment for sure.
I bet.
But Sean Martin at PGA Tour had a good article where he touched on some of the strategy guys are using. He mentioned that there's, you know, three par threes that one set of players will have to tee off on. Mm-hmm. And the par threes here are really long.
Yeah.
A couple of them are similar holes, you know, with water to the left, that they do set up for one guy. If you're a great ball striker like Graham Dillette, you know,
you better be
tee off on those, and yeah, and you get an advantage that way.
So if you were going to pick one team, who would you be going with this week in a one and done? Like, you know, you had to pick one.
See, I think Stenson and Rose are pretty generically solid in terms of how their games match up. Mm-hmm. Both being elite ball strikers. I kind of do like how Spieth and Ryan Palmer set up. Ryan Palmer is a pretty effective driver. He has a decent long game. Jordan Spieth is also, you know, he's very solid around the board in terms of his skill set. So I think they can fit well together. Palmer's a really poor putter and doesn't have a great short game sometimes. So that's not really that much of a sleeper. But
yeah, you didn't really give me any sleepers there.
Yeah. I haven't really dug into the player matchup too much.
That's fine. I'm kind of curious, since you guys advise Lee Westwood, and then you're probably really familiar with Tyrrell Hatton. I keep, whenever I watch him play, Hatton play, I feel like he's very similar to Lee Westwood when he was younger. Is that a good comp for him?
I'm not sure. I'm still not sure exactly what Tyrrell Hatton does great out there. I'm not terribly familiar with his game in general. Mm-hmm. I know he's been putting out of his mind recently.
Yeah,
that's one thing.
Crazy ascension in the last 18 months, but you know, I just think it might be his build and his swing that always makes me think of Westwood. But you know, it's interesting with Lee Westwood. Do you still think he can win a major? I mean, I might be crossing some client here privilege, but I still do. I've got like an ongoing bet with DJ Pyhowski about it.
Yeah, I absolutely think he can. You see him put himself in the position often enough. The main challenge for him is just his ability is deteriorating slowly, just age-related decline. So he's going to run out of opportunities where he's, you know, firing on all cylinders. But in terms of, do I think if he puts himself in the position, he can get it done? I absolutely do.
Yeah.
Especially since so many of the major courses fit his game. So many of the major courses fit that sort of ball striking oriented, drives it well, hits his irons well sort of game.
That's a formula that works pretty much everywhere.
Yeah, absolutely. For sure.
It's I forgot what you were researching. What was that? What did we ask? I can't remember.
Oh, the breakout player.
Yeah, yeah. Who's your breakout player? If it, you know, they could be outside the top 50 or I don't know where you would term it.
See, I didn't do my homework. I was too engrossed in the conversation.
No, it's okay. No, it's fine. Let's talk about a breakout player then. Have you looked in depth at Adam Hadwin at all?
I have. I've looked at his game. Great putter. Ball striking is better this year. Mm-hmm. And that's one of those things that for some guys it comes and goes season to season. You'll see a lot of guys ride a nice, you know, breakout with the irons one season, and then, you know, whatever changes the next year, and they kind of lose it. But mm-hmm. He's a candidate where the rest of his game is good enough if he can, you know, if that skill proves a little sticky and stays around.
You know, I put him on a list that I did at the beginning of the year of breakout players, and I put him on there just like strictly because like, I saw him in contention like twice last year. And like, How, you know, is that a pretty good indicator, like, for a guy that gets into contention, you know, younger guys that get into contention relatively, depending, it doesn't matter really how they play on Sunday, but, like, just getting into contention, is that a good indicator?
I mean, anytime you're at the top of the leaderboard on a Sunday or near the top, you're playing great golf. So, yeah, if someone's popping up in seventh place or ninth place a couple times over the summer, then, yeah. Okay.
So,
you know, that's always a good sign.
Yeah. So I want to dive into some Twitter questions. We got some good ones here. Sean Rehorn wanted to know, with all the data accumulated, like, what surprised you the most?
Ooh. What always amazes me is the narrow margins shot by shot between players. How, if your average proximity to the green is 32 feet versus 36 feet, you're one of the best ball strikers in the world, and 36 your average. You know, that kind of thing, all of these advantages magnified over hundreds and hundreds of shots produce the Tiger Woods. I've always found that incredible.
See, that's something, though, that, like, is astounding to think is, like, 32 feet average proximity. And, like, because, like, this is, like, what we talked about with, like, learning how to play the game more is, like, understanding when you have a 5-iron in, like, 20 feet left is, like, a really good shot and not, you know, necessarily firing at the pin. And, like, when the average proximity is, like, 36 feet, that's, you know, most golfers would probably think it's like 20.
Yeah, absolutely. Because all they're shown on TV is somebody sticking a wedge in from 100 yards to get an 8-footer for birdie.
How do you when you go to a tournament in person, what do you do? I'm kind of curious.
If I'm going as a fan, I'll normally just follow a group. Follow a player, you know, if there's one or two guys I'm interested in, I'll follow them around. And just, if I've never been to the course before, try to walk 18 holes and get a lay of the land. If I'm going there with a client, you know, to work with clients, you know, you'll go on a practice days mostly and be in meetings and on the range and not really get to see much of the course.
Yeah, I kind of prescribe by the same theory you do when you're going as a fan. Is like, I always tell people, pick, you know, a group. Don't pick, you know, like, pick an off the beaten path group that, like, still has, like, really good players in it, like, you know, like, and just watch them play all 18 holes because they'll have less fans, it's easier to get around, and you get to see, like, how they play a golf course.
Yeah, absolutely. I like to go to the Travelers in Connecticut, and that one, there's normally some high-profile players who play there, and, but the other groups, if the high-profile groups are on the back nine, the front nine is desolate. You know, you can follow a group and be one of five people who are walking with them, and you just get to see every shot they hit throughout the round.
You know, I'm kind of curious. You brought up the Travelers, and it spurred my memory to Patrick Cantlay, and I wanted to get your kind of take. I know this is a limited stats, but, like, what do you see from Patrick Cantlay? And, you know, obviously, everybody, I think, hopes he stays healthy. But what kind of in his game has, you know, popped, and why he's played so well and so few starts?
Yeah, well, he's my answer for the breakout player, even though he might have already broken out.
Yeah.
Already by the numbers through his first four or five tournaments back, he's, you know, he looks incredible. Looks like he's going to, you know, pick up easily and, you know, finish as, like, a top 25 or top 50 player in the world once he gets enough starts.
Yeah, he was unbelievable in college. It's unbelievable that he kind of the whole thing that's happened, and, you know, he overshadowed Spieth in college, which is crazy, you know, and how good.
Oh, exactly, yeah. And those guys who are number one, number two players in the world for a few years in college and as amateurs almost always turn out to be at the very least top 50 guys in the world.
That's what I said to Tron the other day, and he but, like, because, like, I still am in on Casey Wittenberg, you know. I think he's gonna make
it might be a little long for Casey Wittenberg, but
Hey, I'm in on it. I haven't sold my property yet.
Yeah, no, we'll see.
All right, Sean Martin wants to know, what's the next frontier for golf stats? And, you know, how will they more accurately depict what occurs on the course? What's the next frontier? He asked like three questions in one.
Yeah, Sean got a little greedy with that one.
Yeah.
I would say just really create. So we have strokes gained, which is fantastic, and it's really helped us understand why players are getting it done and why they aren't. So I think that's great. The next step is to dig into maybe more granular examinations, mm-hmm. sort of like that missed fairway stat I talked about earlier. There was a great piece, I can't remember who wrote it, from last year or the year before, about what makes Jordan Spieth such a great putter, and it's because he always gets it to the hole. He always gives it a chance. Mm-hmm. So I think a stat like that, like who are the guys who are always giving it a chance versus the ones who are trying to dive into the hole? Just really these new stats to help us understand the parts of a player's game. And that's what we've seen in other sports. Baseball has this radar system which tracks everyone on the field now. And so you can tell how far a player ran to catch a ball. And so they rank, you know, who's the fastest outfielder, you know, who makes more catches, who, you know, hits the ball the hardest. And all those sort of stats are, you know, getting people more comfortable with these. It just gives you more tools for someone like Sean to tell a story about a player.
Yeah.
And to get fans interested. And the broadcast can use these things just to tell the story a little bit better. So when Sam Saunders is out there, it's not just, well, he's Arnie's grandson. We can actually talk a little bit about what makes him a good player.
Yeah, I think that's, you know, it's the out of the box narratives are just awful. It's a, you know, at least put some context behind why he's a professional golfer rather than he's, you know, the son or grandson of Arnold Palmer or friends with Jordan Spieth. It's the stats can fill that void. This kind of relates to what you were just talking about, and I think this is interesting. Like, do you currently have the ability to with stats to tell who performs better on a back nine in a major or other bit, like a nerve stat?
Yeah, we do calculate around basically looking at how someone plays in contention under like stressful rounds, we call it. And that just looks at if you enter a round within a shot or two of the lead, how do you play with the lead versus how you normally play? So if you're Rory McIlroy and you normally beat the field by X amount, then how do you play under pressure? And vice versa, if you're six back going into the fourth round, how do you play? How do you play when there isn't as much to play for?
Yeah.
And there's a lot of work to be done in that area. We just in the last few weeks, we've rolled out basically a win probability model where we're going to be tracking, with more exact numbers, how people, if you have a 40% chance by our model on the 10th hole, the final round, you know, how do you play going in from there? Mm-hmm. So I think the data is out there. It's just a matter of, you know, putting it together.
Who's like the best in contention by your metrics?
So neither of these guys have been in contention very often. I think only about a dozen or 15 times. But Thomas Peters and Matt Fitzpatrick pretty much always have gotten the job done when they're in contention. Or at least when I say got the job done, they've played better than they normally play uh-huh. in other rounds.
I'm a big fan of Fitzpatrick. Do the stats prove out, you know, like, is he a really, you know, like, tell us a little bit about, like, what makes him so good.
His ball striking's excellent, and his putting is excellent. And those are two pretty decent cornerstones to build your game around.
Yeah. Is Jordan Spieth a good comparison for him?
I think Jordan Spieth is a longer hitter than him. Mm-hmm. And I think Fitz might be a little bit better of a ball striker. Spieth kind of has these good years and these bad years. Mm-hmm. But I think overall that's not a bad comparison for what Matt could be if he added some more distance to his game. That's sort of like a high target for him to reach.
Yeah, I mean, like, I imagine if he could have, like, some sort of, like, a Justin Rose, like, renaissance, like, that, what that guy did to his game, like, is unbelievable to me with, like, how he added, like, 30 yards. Like, it's not easy to add 30 yards to your tee shot.
Oh, yeah, absolutely. And there's been a handful of guys who have done that. Brendan Steele, like I mentioned earlier. Mm-hmm. But Justin Rose is a completely different player than he was even 8 or 10 years ago. So, yeah, I think that's definitely in play for Fitz. And when he already comes in here putting extremely well and ball striking's great, he could has a really high potential.
Okay. I got a quick question for you. And next first-time winner, major winner, who's it going to be?
So who among the elite guys hasn't won one? Fowler, Hideki, and John Rahm?
Yeah, and then you've got a ton of young guys. You've got, you know, you've got Paul Casey's right there, Justin Thomas. You got Norin, Hatton, Kuchar, Koepka.
Yeah, so I can't say Kuchar, or I might get blocked on Twitter by some people.
No, you can say Kuchar. That's fine. You're in a safe haven here. We there's not as much hate on Kuchar. I kind of.
I would say the next major winner is probably Rahm, mm-hmm. first timer.
Okay.
I think his game sets up well for Aaron Hills. I think it sets up well for Quail Hollow too. So. I think he'll be in serious contention at both of those.
It's interesting. So I had this talk with Sarsen and Tron and DJ after the Masters, and I was talking about how I'd probably take if it was a major and I had three guys, I think Justin Rose would be in my three, like with you know probably Dustin and Rory. Who would be your or Dustin and Spieth? Who would be your three that you'd pick if it was every major championship, you get your top three, and it, you know, knowing the courses.
Yeah, I think I would pick Spieth because his game kind of travels to a lot of different courses.
Mm-hmm.
And then DJ and Rory because they're the best. So yeah. That isn't very exciting, but.
So I'm off base going with Rose.
I mean, Rose is a great player. He's right up there. In terms of ball striking travels, so.
Mm-hmm. Okay, all right. We're gonna get you out of here. You've been more than gracious with your time and listening to my stupid questions. So let's go with our tradition of overrated, underrated. So you just you got to decide if they're no middle ground here. All right.
Oh, I'm ready. Yeah.
All right. Practice rounds.
Underrated, as long as you do them right.
What do you have to do them right?
We don't really work with players in terms of practice round type stuff, but I'd like to turn a few guys into some guinea pigs and figure out how to do them right. So that's where I'm coming from.
I'll be your. I play practice rounds for these tournaments. What would you do if you were me in a practice round?
So if you play a course that the pros play every year, I think we would just walk around and pick out maybe 8 key shots in the round,
mm-hmm.
and really talk through caddy, StatGeek, and player, and really talk through strategy in terms of those shots, bringing data and how comfortable a player is hitting a certain shot and all that sort of stuff.
Yeah, that's a good point. It's like, because like when you're uncomfortable, that's usually when you hit bad shots.
Yeah, that's why I try not to stray too much into criticizing players for laying up or, you know, whatever during tournaments is they might not be super comfortable hitting that particular shot in that particular wind to that particular green that day.
Yeah.
And that the solution to that is just, you know, realize that that shot might be coming and try to prepare for it.
Interesting. All right. The equipment transition period when you change equipment.
Overrated.
I think so too. It's so similar. Do you what do you guys see with like that? I'm turning all these quick questions into long ones.
Yeah, it's not something that I know too much about. Okay. I can't give you that much of an informed opinion.
Laying up.
Overrated.
All right, so be aggressive.
Be aggressive, yes.
Jet lag and international travel.
Oh, wow, this is definitely properly rated. I think people really get it. Though I would say, let's say underrated, because you still see guys who are flying back from Asia to play in tournaments the next week, which is crazy to my mind.
Bubba's doing it this week.
Yeah, Bubba's doing it. There were a few guys who played in the European Tour event in India the week before the match play, and that's basically flying around the world. We saw, at least anecdotally, what happened to Spieth a year ago. Mm-hmm. Yeah, I think underrated in terms of how players make their decisions.
Yeah. I'm curious, you know, the last question now is Bubba and the golf balls. Has there been like a statistical change since he switched to the putt-putt balls?
Yeah, he's terrible now. the ball striking's bad. His wedge play is bad. Which makes sense if you're going to play if it's an inferior ball, if it's something he isn't used to. But who knows? Who has any insight into that head? So,
do you think JB and them are going to use the Volvic during alternate shot?
I hope not, for their sake. I can't imagine what it would be like for JB Holmes to use an orange or a pink ball that he's never hit before for 9 holes or even 18.
I remember I one time hit my mom's like women's ball, and the way it launches with like a 9 iron is insanely different.
Yeah.
Like I couldn't even imagine playing something like that and like trying to get used to it.
Yeah, I think that's to play overrated, underrated on the ball thing, I think it seems like it would be something that I'd at least want my partner to spend some time with it the week before and in practice rounds getting used to it.
So like the $1 million a year he gets paid by them, I think personally that he's losing that in on-course earnings.
Oh, if he's playing like he is now, he's losing more than that. He's like a $5 million player if he plays like he is the last few years.
Uh-huh.
And playing like this, he's, you know, he's gonna make $3 million less probably.
Unbelievable.
If he can't figure something out. Yeah.
Good smart decision making. But
who knows, he might turn it around and make us look at like idiots for criticizing him, but
yeah, the Volvic revolution is happening. He just has to get used to it.
Yeah.
He could just start painting the ball too, you know?
Yeah, do the what was it? Tiger used to do that?
Yeah.
Have somebody paint the Nikes, the swoosh one.
Yeah.
Yeah, I think he might want to just go to Titleist and say, "Hey, can you put some paint on these balls?"
Yeah. We'll get out on the Bubba talk. Thanks for coming on. And if anybody doesn't follow Jake, he's a great Twitter follow. If people are interested in 15th Club, I guess you just fill out a contact form.
Yeah, we have a contact form on the website, and also just follow us on Twitter, and we're happy to talk on there. It's at 15th Club.
Uh-huh.
And always you can reach out to me too. So
awesome. Well, thanks for
coming
on.
Happy to talk golf.